Sky News Centre at 6. The Prime Minister's announced a major shutdown across the UK.
We are collectively telling cafes, pubs, bars and restaurants to close tonight as soon as they reasonably can and not to open tomorrow.
Boris Johnson says they'll still be able to provide takeaway services. He's also announced theatres, leisure centres and gyms will shut as well. The Chancellor, meanwhile, has revealed another major package of financial measures to support businesses and keep people in work during the coronavirus outbreak. Rishi Sunak says the government will cover 80% of wage costs for staff who aren't working because of the crisis.
We want to look back on this time and remember how, in the face of a generation-defining moment, we undertook a collective national effort and we stood together.
Certain benefits will rise, self-employed people are getting extra help and VAT is being deferred to help firms' cash flow. Earlier it was revealed the number of people who've died after contracting coronavirus in the UK has risen to 177. In England it's jumped by 39, the biggest increase in a day, while there was one death in Wales. Exam boards in England will ask teachers to grade pupils for their GCSEs and A-levels. They'll have to take into account things like mock exam results and other schoolwork. Leora Cruddas from the Confederation of Schools Trusts is relieved they now have some clarity.
Obviously, in normal circumstances, it would be better if young people sat their exams, but we are in a national crisis and this is absolutely the right way forward. It gives teachers and leaders some much-needed clarity and reassurance.
So this is the BCFM Politics Show. It's Martin Summers and Roma Widger in the studio and we're talking about, well, guess what? Apparently there is no other news in the world but the virus. And of course we've just heard probably less than an hour ago that pubs and everything else in the way of entertainment is to close. London is in lockdown. That is the news today, and we'll be talking, I suspect, mainly about that. We'll be covering Prime Minister's Question Time, the latest moves in the fight against the virus, and we also have a guest today. It's Anthony Negus, yes, he's a Liberal Democrat councillor, and he'll be filling us in about what the Lib Dems are planning or hoping for in Bristol after all this is over. Because, as the Prime Minister keeps telling us, we will get through it. So, for now, we're talking about the virus. And, Martin, what's your take on today's latest announcement?
Just from a personal point of view, I'm working at schools and we sent the kids home this afternoon and, it was very emotional for them and for the teachers because nobody knows when the end of this is going to come. We could start scoring political points by saying, well, you know, should they have done things differently and all the rest of it? Those kind of questions do need to be asked. There's no particular reason why we should just presume that they know what they're doing. And, of course, the other side of this, which most people are still not really focused on, is the economic effects of it, which are basically disastrous. Even if we manage to knock the coronavirus on the head in quick, short order, which is a big if, the economic effects are already catastrophic because of the bursting of the everything bubble, which has been built up since 2008. And that was going to happen either way. It's not the coronavirus. The coronavirus is just the reason for that to go down. It's just the trigger, because it's the most overbought market in history on the back of very unconventional monetary policy, and that's what we should have been talking about for 12 years, but we've wasted a lot of time and now we're talking about the virus, which of course we have to, but people need to see the bigger picture. The tsunami coming behind that is the collapse of the global economy, which of course is going to kill millions in all sorts of different ways.
Yes, and in Prime Minister's Question Time on Wednesday, it was really surprising and quite refreshing that they kicked off with a question about hospital in Aylesbury and would it be able to progress with its refit? And it was almost like, wow, something that isn't the virus. But of course, we soon moved on. And our friend Jeremy Corbyn, he got quite a lot to say, as you would imagine. And this is in addition to the other questions that were asked about, well, self-employed people, gig economy, people on 0 hours contract. He had a specific point about sick pay.
Jeremy Corbyn.
The UK sick pay levels lag far behind those of European counterparts. The Scandinavian countries are giving many of them 100% of wages during this crisis. And I hope that when the Prime Minister brings forward proposals on this, they do reflect the reality of people's lives. You cannot feed a family on 90-odd quid a week. And those people, therefore, are putting everybody at risk because they have to go out to work in order to put food on the table. And to claim statutory sick pay, workers need to prove they earn a minimum of £118 per week. So I hope when the Prime Minister brings forward proposals, he will give confidence to the millions of people who work on low-income jobs, are in insecure work or self-employed, and commit to extending a very much enhanced statutory sick pay to all workers. Yes.
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I told the House before, of course we will ensure that nobody is penalised for doing the right thing and protecting not just themselves, but also other members of society, and of course making sure that our NHS is able to cope. And clearly statutory sick pay will typically be supplemented by other benefits, but we will ensure, and I just repeat what I said to the right honourable gentleman, we will ensure, since the state is after all making these demands of the public and of business, it is only right that throughout this period we should be doing whatever it takes to support the workers of this country throughout this crisis.
Jeremy Corbyn.
What it takes is a recognition of the social injustice and inequalities that exist in this country. And I hope that when the Prime Minister makes the proposals on statutory sick pay levels, that will be recognised. A quarter of the people that are most crucial to support us in this crisis, social care staff, and almost half of home care workers, are on 0 hours contract, so therefore automatically not entitled to sick pay. By not extending statutory sick pay to all workers, the government is forcing social care staff, and they're the people that could unwittingly be transmitting the disease amongst the most vulnerable in our community, to choose between health and their own hardship. Yesterday, the Chancellor, unfortunately, offered nothing to the 20 million people living in rented homes, including 3 million households with children. They're worried. They're worried sick that they can't pay their rent if they get ill, lose pay, or feel they need to self-isolate. It is in the interest of public health, of the health of all of us, that people don't feel forced to go to work in order to avoid eviction when they know themselves they may be spreading this terrible disease. So will the Prime Minister now confirm that the government's emergency legislation will protect private renters from eviction?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I can indeed confirm that. I mean, he's making a series of very powerful points, and I can indeed confirm that we will be bringing forward legislation to protect private renters from eviction. That is one thing we'll do, but it is also important as we legislate that we do not simply pass on the problem. So we'll also be taking steps to protect other actors in the economy.
Now, Martin, we know since that statement was made that, in fact, there is a three-month ban on evictions. But the general tone in Parliament this week, as you probably heard, it was all very, I suppose, not playing to the gallery, that sounds a mean thing to say, but everybody was flying their own flag and thanking everybody and being seen to thank everybody. But as leaders, We've got Boris and Corby. What do you think? Do you think they've come out as strong leaders? Do you think this is showing them in a good light?
Well, I think it was interesting that the tone of that was very different from Prime Minister's questions not that long ago, which is basically a shouting match.
Yeah.
And frankly, we often have Prime Minister's questions clips on this show, and I've frequently said it's a rubbish way to run things to do it like this. I mean, when I lived in Poland, I went to the Polish Parliament, and it's a circular building, custom built, so they all sit in a circle like you do with infant children, and they go up to the microphone and they get 10 minutes, and then they finish, they get the light goes on and they go back to their seats. And most people, it's like watching paint dry. It's a place of work, whereas the British Parliament is basically a place of theatre. It's not the same thing. Because, of course, they've got coalition forces. They constantly have to negotiate. I mean, basically, the Sejmiks, the parliamentarians in Poland, will sit in their offices watching what's going on in the chamber. Meanwhile, in actual fact, they're going round to each other's offices and having cups of coffee and chatting about what they're plotting to do. Yeah, but it's a different way of doing it. Yeah, we think our way of doing it is the way. But in any case, that Prime Minister's questions was much more constructive than you'd have heard in the past. And that's because the Tories are having to confront the fact that, you know, there is such a thing as society and that the free market doesn't solve all the problems. So in other words, that's staring everybody in the face. And that's why they're able to find common ground, because they've suddenly had to turn around and look and think, yes, that's the reality of the situation. And of course, it's in a moment of opportunity, a crisis like this. We should have been talking, as I said earlier, since 2008, there should have been a massive discussion about what to do about the banking system. But in actual fact, we bailed them out and then forgot about it, and then went off to have a sort of a parlour game called Brexit and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, that's what we should have been talking about. And if it wasn't the coronavirus outbreak, it would have been something else which would have tipped it over. And of course, once you've got margin calls in this kind of massive overbought market, it just crashes like a stone. They've got no ammunition left to stop it going right down the drain. And of course, at that point, what happens is the government willy-nilly has to hold the baby. Even conservative governments have to hold the baby. The baby is just handed to them and say, there's the baby, what are you going to do about it? But of course, they hadn't thought that the baby was going to be put in their hands, which is one of the problems. They're making it up as they go along.
Yes, I think the Conservatives did think they were just going to cruise through another parliament. But it's like watching some very stroppy adolescents growing up on screen, I feel.
Well, that's right. I mean, but don't forget that the kind of ill-tempered stuff we've had around Brexit in this, it's a kind of luxury you can't afford. I mean, when I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia, I used to go there for a week's work and come back, and you know, you'd look people in the eye and you could see what they were thinking. You're going home, but we're not.
Yeah.
And of course, that's serious, because everything's falling apart, and it's just, you know, that can happen. And of course, what happens in consumer society like ours is people get the idea that, you know, it's just about going shopping, which your next holiday is going to be, and all this sort of stuff. And the bad stuff happens to other people on the telly, but not to you. And of course, in the real world, that isn't the case. And one way or another, the reality of life eventually intrudes, doesn't it?
It does. And I think that particularly in some of the, you know, more needy areas and people that are on lesser incomes, they are getting to be a little bit embittered by this.
Well, I'm 60 years old and I'm very embittered about what's happened in this country in my lifetime. You know, when I went to university, I left without a penny of debt. There was council housing for all those that needed it, and new ones were built all the time to make sure that there was enough, and all of that. And it's just gone down the drain, and we've just got used to having a completely impoverished public realm. And, you know, we just kind of, you know, we had 13 years of Labour government with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and certain things just were not changed. They just said, well, for example, there's a big pressure, but why don't we renationalise the railways? Because obviously that's what most people want. In New Zealand, they were renationalised, having been privatised. And they said, well, we can't afford that. That can't be a priority. We've got to do other things. NHS, that's got to come first. And we sort of grumbled but accepted it. And then the banks crash and suddenly the money's no object. And of course, that's what's going to happen now. All the big corporations that have been making out like bandits, Boeing and you know, General Motors and all the others, Jaguar, Land Rover and all the rest of it, will turn around to the government now and say, if you don't bail us out, we're going under. And then the government, which means you and me as taxpayers, will underpin the so-called free market. And of course, the free market actually died in 2008. It's a donkey that's dead, and you can keep hitting it with a stick, but it's not going to get up again. The governments of the world are going to have to pick up the tab here, as the Communist Party in China are very well aware, but not the politicians in the West, because their ideology forbids them to think in those terms until they're forced to.
And one of the alarming things for, I think, quite a lot of us, I thought that we were as poor as church mice, and now suddenly the new Chancellor is throwing billions at the problem. Do we have billions? I think not.
Well, the thing is, you can, money creation is a bit of a... I mean, John Kenneth Galbraith, the US economist, said money creation is so simple that it boggles the mind when you actually know what's going on. The idea is that the government controls the money supply. That's what it says in old-fashioned textbooks. But in actual fact, the money supply is created by banks. When banks, which are private institutions, lend you money, they just make it up and lend it to you. That's what happens. It's as simple as that. And that's how money is created. Now, and because of that, there are things you can do. The government could do that and cut out the middleman of having a private bank doing it. Now, there's obviously a limit to how much money you can create. If you create too much money, you can create inflation or hyperinflation. But that doesn't mean that the government shouldn't create money, because the private sector creating money creates a problem, because they want to lend money when people don't want it, have some money, because that's what we do, that's what we're selling. And then, of course, when people do need it in a crisis like this, they want to draw it all back in. That's what's happening now. The banks are insolvent. They've been insolvent for 12 years. And, of course, this is now exposing that. And the answer to that is for the government to actually national... I mean, basically, if these companies are all bailed out by the government, they're owned by the government. But, of course, they're not owned by the government. The banks... What happened in 2008 is they took all the money, and then they're trying to get back to being private sector again. That was an opportunity to say, right, well, that's the end of private banking. Now, these are radical thoughts, but in a situation like this, they're not that radical. They're the only solution, frankly. There is no private sector solution to a global crisis like this.
No.
There just isn't one.
But I think you're absolutely right, Martin, to concentrate on the financial. I mean, this problem of the virus is a massive, massive problem. It's more than money. It's a social problem. It's a health problem. It's a long-term political problem. All we seem to really hear about, though, is money. And, we know that money is a problem, but it almost seems as though everything now is governed purely in fiscal terms.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, if you think about it in terms of in Northern Italy, for example, they're already turning away people over a certain age from hospitals. And that's what doctors do after bomb attacks or in any disaster. You have to do what they call triage, which is what they did in the First World War and all the rest of it. There's some who probably get better on their own, so you don't do much for them. There's some who are going to die anyway, so you don't bother doing anything for them. And the third lot of patients are the ones that you intervene, because they're the ones that you might save with the resources available. And that stuff is, you could say that's cynical, but it's basically standard practice in all medical emergencies.
Survival of the fittest?
Well, it's not survival of the fittest, because the fittest, you allow them to survive, that you actually concentrate on the middle. If people are going to die anyway, you can try and mitigate that in terms of making their... there's no reason that they should suffer as they go down the drain. But if you can't save them, you've got limited resources. You know, if this happens after car accidents, you know, the doctors on the spot will go, right, well, this was the one we're going to concentrate on, because he's going to die anyway, and this other woman is probably going to be all right. So we're not going to intervene there.
That is an unpopular facet of this whole crisis. Everybody, though, seems to have something to say about the, you know, priorities, the health. And this was Jeremy Corbyn talking about, well, I'll let him say it.
Depends on the health of the most vulnerable. So I ask the Prime Minister, will he step up now and not tomorrow and give support to those vulnerable people who live on the margins of our society, are vulnerable themselves and make us all vulnerable, and give them the support and the assurance that they desperately are searching for today.
Yeah, I mean, it's an unpopular thing to think about not surviving. It's all about the health of the neediest and so on. And I guess that there will be people tonight who are miffed about not being able to go out. But as Boris has said, it's to protect the, you know, the needy ones.
Well, I mean, some people would say this is an overreaction or whatever, but I think the argument in favour of going hard early is that you can squeeze the virus down, you know, in terms of overwhelming your healthcare system. So, the Chinese, if their stats are to be believed, and of course there are some questions about whether they're making the stats up, that they have managed using their traditional methods that they would have used in communist China. You know, they lock the place down. They've got the police controlling the situation. You know, and the society is pretty well disciplined as well. You know, it's a disciplined society. That's their aspiration, and they've managed to squash it. It looks like they've got no new infections or deaths today. I can't remember the exact figures, but of course the problem is that for them is that as you release the pressure, it all comes back.
Yes. Well, it was the middle of this week. I think it was probably about Wednesday when the Chinese said they had had no new cases.
Yeah. In the yeah.
That is a turning point.
Well, it is, but of course the problem is that they've got to keep all the structures in place that they've got, because that's the economy's collapsing because they've got all the structure. I mean, Wuhan is like Manchester, you know, or Chicago, and if you close that down, that's closed down an awful lot. And of course, because Trump was going on about the Chinese virus and the Chinese started this and it's a foreign virus and all the rest of it, they took great umbrage at that. And their spokespeople were saying, well, actually, we're looking into this, and it looks as if your military were active around Wuhan just as this virus was emerging. And the Fort Detrick in Maryland, which was the source of the anthrax, which eventually was sent to various politicians and killed six people after 9/11, that closed down in July last year because they said it was an unsafe facility. Oh. And what the Chinese are suggesting is that in actual fact, coronavirus has been running riot inside the US. And then in order to cover it up, they have seeded it in China. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard are saying, we think you've seeded this here. And of course, in Latin America, many people believe that the left-wing elected presidents in Latin America, like Nestor Kirchner and Chavez died of very, very rare cancer. And he had three bouts of very, very rare cancer. And in the Korean War, lots of evidence shows that the Western powers used biological and chemical weaponry to, basically in an exterminatory fashion against their opposition. So the Chinese military will be very aware of all of this. And of course, there's a subtext underlying all of this. If we're going to start shouting names and pointing fingers, what's underlying this? It may just be that this is an accidental virus, or it may be a bioweapon. And a bioweapon will be designed not to kill lots of people, but to crash economies. Yeah. Mm. And of course, there's lots of questions that need to be asked about this. But it's not just me saying this. The Chinese government are saying this, and so are the Iranian government. And they're saying, we're not sure, but you need to think about this because we're thinking about it.
And of course, the other thing about any type of national crisis like this is it's a bit like living under the cosh for the people, isn't it?
Well, it gives an opportunity for disaster capitalism to be got going. Have you heard the phrase disaster capitalism?
Yeah.
Naomi Klein's book. And of course, she basically was doing research into the tsunami and the follow-on from the tsunami in Sri Lanka. And of course, what happened was all these poor communities, which have been fishing villages along the coast, they were all wiped out, and it was treated as an opportunity to get rid of these people and build luxury hotels. Same thing happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. All these poor neighbourhoods were wiped out, the people fled, and guess what? They never came back, because the whole area was then redeveloped as, luxury flats, etc. This is the way this works, yeah?
And it's extreme and visible in the way that you describe it. I think, though, that probably as a nation we're fairly undisciplined.
Who, the US?
No, the Brits. I mean,
oh yes, we are. Yeah, but at the same time, during the war, there was quite a disciplined attitude, and obviously, the you know, our society is notoriously liberal compared to other places. But I think there is actually, you know, and also people going about how Brits are very reserved and so on. But generally speaking, I find that British people, look at our driving.
Yes.
I think our driving is rather good, actually. And we do actually. I mean, if you go and drive in foreign countries, you realise that British driving is actually quite good. People actually do take care of other people on the road, and they are quite careful about it. And the police, obviously, you know, they've been encouraging good driving. I was done for speeding some years ago, and instead of being fined, they said, we want you to take attending you to a driving seminar for the day. And we were all grumbling about being in there. But by the end of it, we were all talking about good driving, bad driving, and what good drivers were and bad drivers were.
You only got caught once.
Sorry?
You only got caught once.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, the point is I could have been fined and lost points on my licence, but instead they made me do this course, which is actually good.
Yeah.
And it was a good thing to talk to other people about driving and doing driving. So, in other words, there's two sides to the British character, isn't there?
There is two sides. But, I mean, looking at a long-term perspective of the social makeup of Britain, we are a nation now that believes that everybody's opinion counts. Everybody has to have their voice amplified. And everybody, well, there was a fellow on the television last night and he said, I'm going to do what I want. Well, today, if I could just summarise, Boris Johnson has put London and the rest of the UK on lockdown. And pubs, restaurants, cinemas and cafes, they've been closed down from tonight in an attempt to stop people mixing with others and also to stop non-essential journeys.
Mm-hmm.
So there were 953 cases of the virus confirmed in London. That was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the worst area for the coronavirus epidemic. And there are now many cases recorded in Westminster, as many, in fact, as the whole of Northern Ireland. So lockdown is a way of enforcing the government's suppression strategy for the virus by law. So it's shut down businesses, schools, public transport. People are being asked, no, people are being required to stay inside. Cinemas, gyms, theatres, leisure centres, they're closing. And the government has ruled out shutting off the capital entirely and preventing the traffic going in and out. It's still possible to travel. But, I mean, this is unthinkable.
Well,
six
it is.
6 months ago.
Yes, but 6 months ago, I mean, we were talking earlier about what the Chinese did. I mean, they were obviously a bit flat-footed in relation in dealing with this. But once they realised what was going on, they basically put into practice what they'd have been preparing for years, which was a biological warfare attack. Yeah?
Yeah.
So whether it's a biological warfare attack or not, the fact that they've been preparing for one for years, because they expected that the West might do something like that, they were ready to deal with it. Whereas what's happening here is we're playing catch-up. Now, it'll be interesting to see if pubs and clubs stay open, or shebeens stay open, I suppose, you could find what they're going to do to try and close them down. But I think in any case, even if people do disobey, like the smoking ban, we all thought the Brits would never tolerate that in pubs, you know. Mm. But in actual fact, they did, because it was a reasonable request. You know, why should bar staff be exposed to smoking? It's not reasonable, is it? It's perfectly reasonable to go outside and smoke. And he's not saying you can't do it, but there's no reason why the whole room should smell of smoke and the people who are working there have to put up with it.
I think that was one of those political moves which has actually got a bit of a silver lining. I remember when they stopped people smoking and we all thought that pubs would probably close down and that kind of thing.
They adapted.
They've adapted. But in fact now there's a lot of people alive that wouldn't have been.
Well, indeed. And in actual facts, you know, I mean, even the smokers accept that that's reasonable. I mean, you see, people will accept restrictions if they can see the purpose of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, people are probably, you know, actually really panicking too much. I mean, people going to supermarkets and clearing the shelves is not helpful. Do you know what I mean? That's not helpful behaviour. But it certainly means that they're taking it seriously.
They were talking about morality earlier on. They were saying, I think the question was asked of the Prime Minister, if he thought it was actually immoral to shop in the way that some people have. And You know, I must say, I was at a warehouse last night and it looked like some sort of medieval rout had taken place. It was unbelievable.
Well, also, the other thing that crosses me, because, of course, in Eastern, I think we're quite lucky because lots of little shops around here are perfectly well stocked and people haven't panicked at all.
Yeah.
But that's because we're used to just popping out for a little bit of this and that. Yeah. We just do it all the time. And we're pretty confident that it's not going to disappear. And, of course, not many people from outside the area come to shop in these shops either.
No.
Because they're small shops. Why would they come here?
That's right.
So anyway, we've been quite lucky. But I mean, everybody turning up to Walmart in huge numbers, if we're talking about spreading the virus, where shouldn't you be? Shouldn't you just, you know, or everybody turning up to the shops in one go, they've misunderstood what this is about. They think that what's going to happen, they're going to be stuck at home and they won't be able to go out shopping and they're going to miss their treats. In actual fact, the whole purpose of shutting everything down is so that people, you know, don't interact with each other. So going along to a massive, you know, warehouse raid with everybody else with your cars is actually exposing yourself to virus, potentially.
Yeah. And there's another side to this, because everybody is thinking, well, I'm sure they're thinking of themselves and their families and their neighbours, but there's a downside of society and they are massively losing out. Because what I did notice was empty shelves in the supermarket and the warehouse and the charity food bin, it's different in each shop. But the idea is there's a big wire bin and you put something in it for people as you go out. There was hardly anything in it. It was nauseating.
Well, yes, and of course, you know, we've got a substantial section of the population who struggle to put food on the table just in normal times.
It's so much worse for them at the moment.
Well, I mean, what happens in all of these crises is the most vulnerable are the ones that are most likely to suffer.
Yes.
Let's face it. You know, the super wealthy have self-isolated ages ago with all their flunkies, you know, properly tested, etc. And there's, you know, you see, if you knew that something like this was going to happen, you could position your investments to make a lot of money.
Yes.
And, of course, that's what happened on 9/11. Somebody put options on the airlines involved and made a huge load of money. And, of course, at the time they said, well, that must be bin Laden. So they checked into it. And do you know where the trail led back to? It led back to Buzzy Krongard, executive director of the CIA. And that's why we've not heard any more about it. But, of course, somebody knew because somebody put those put options in. And it wasn't bin Laden. I think Sherlock Holmes would have something to say about that, don't you?
Yes. Now, I think we touched on that subject last week, didn't we? So let's hear a voice from the past.
May.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Right honourable friend is rightly engrossed day to day in dealing with the developments of COVID-19. But I'd like to ask him to cast his mind a little further forward. The Chief Scientific Advisor and the Chief Medical Officer have been clear that the best solution for this is a vaccine, but the Chief Scientific Advisor has said that that could be as much as a year away. I believe he's also suggested that until that vaccine is available, it may be difficult to ease restrictions successfully. Does my right honourable friend agree with that analysis? And if so, what does a sensible exit strategy look like?
Mr. Speaker, the objective of the government and the objective of our scientific advisers is to depress the peak of the epidemic, to make sure that we get through it so that we come out on the other side, and that we do that as fast as possible. I'm not going to give and that's why we're taking all the measures that we've announced. That's why we've announced the package of business support that we have. I'm not going to give a timescale on it, but that is the strategy, and I'm absolutely certain that it will succeed.
Now, I mentioned that because we were saying last week that Mr. May was lucky when the last time this happened. And Mrs. May is still going out to work, and she has mentioned the vaccine thing. And, yeah, I mean, it's another example, isn't it, of the government having to step up.
Well, I mean, the thing about crises like this is it brings home the need for planning, if you like, as opposed to markets, you know, on a more, you know, on an abstract level. And even the most solid free marketeers have to accept that the market isn't just going to come up with a solution here, is it? Let's face it. And of course, interestingly enough, we were talking about put options. When Mrs. May decided that she was going to attack Syria as a result of the so-called chemical weapons attack at Douma, which has been substantially debunked subsequently, the actual specialist who went in there said in their report that there was no evidence of a chemical weapons attack. And they've been speaking out, but in other words, that was all a put up job. But the decision to carry out the attack was made, and Mr. May must have had prior information because he's basically married to the Prime Minister, and he put all of his investments in the right position to make money out of the thing that, when it took place the following day. So he bought loads of shares in Raytheon and Boeing and all these other military companies.
The health of us all depends on the health of the most vulnerable. So I ask the Prime Minister, will he step up now and not tomorrow?
Yes.
That was repeated again. Well, I mean, that's a very good point to repeat, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, that's why Bristol was one of the last cities in the country to bring in proper sewage works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the shopocracy that ran Bristol in the 19th century, we're not spending money on that, you know. And of course, there was a cholera epidemic, which even rich people died of, and they thought, well, actually, we probably do need some sanitation around here. But it took them ages.
Well, yeah.
They dragged their feet all the way.
And the drains are still rubbish.
Well, yes, but they didn't even exist at one stage. I mean, what's now the harbour where everybody has their chichi, evenings out, that was basically just sewage. And of course that caused all kinds of health issues.
And actually, on the subject of that, did you realise that it was actually in the 60s that it was discovered that a lot of the houses in Bedminster were still draining their rubbish into the water?
Well, yes. I mean, at one stage, this is it. I mean, the public health is not something. This is one of the problems that the US is going to find as this crisis develops, is that they haven't got a public health system of any kind. People have got some kind of private insurance if they're lucky, and most people don't go to the doctor unless they're absolutely dying because they can't afford it. Now, in those situations, you're not in a position to have a public health campaign that's going to be successful. Unlike communist China, of course, where healthcare, or Cuba, can you imagine? In Cuba, they will just say, right, we're going to get coronavirus. Is everybody ready? You know, they've got that's one of the things they've done well over there. Their health service is exemplary. They don't have a lot of money, still a poor country, people don't have a lot of opportunities, but the healthcare is exemplary, and they will know what to do.
And I think it's welfare that concerns a lot of people, because today I walked past the museum, there was a fellow laying on the pavement, notice in front of him, and I looked at him and I thought, nobody is caring for you. Everybody else is being herded inside. There is a large amount of people who are rough sleepers,
yep,
people who have got no security. We already know that there are children who, because the schools have closed, they will possibly go hungry.
Yeah.
And it is alarming.
Yeah, but if you think about it, a very infectious disease like this, if they all get it, they're going to give it to you.
Yeah.
So unless you're going to eliminate them physically, and of course in Latin America you have these death squads that go out and kill homeless people. They're run by the right wing, and they're paid for by local business groups usually, and street children and so on. They all end up dead. But unless you're going to do that, and even if you do that, you might catch virus from them while you're strangling them or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's you can't really protect yourself in a situation like this, and it reminds people that we are all human, vulnerable people, you know.
And I think we do pride ourselves in having a few more morals in this country as well. I think actually what we need to do is just take this as an opportunity to try and get a better situation.
Oh, yeah.
We don't want to revisit this again,
no,
ever.
No, I mean, in many ways, this is an inflection point as big as World War II or World War I. That's what it is. And in fact, it may well be World War III. That's what we're talking about. Because, of course, the Chinese and the Russians and the West are at daggers drawn. We've nearly, because of the coronavirus bit, but people have failed to notice that the Turkish army and the Russian army went to blows in Syria not that long ago. And it was talked, they talked each other down, but Turkey's part of NATO. Yeah?
Yeah.
We nearly went there.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, that's what can happen, especially because of all sorts of recriminations are now circulating about where this virus comes from and what it was, you know, because they've got a bio lab in Wuhan, the Chinese, but the US have got hundreds of bio labs all over the world, which are run by the Pentagon. Why does the Pentagon have bio labs in Georgia and Jordan and all these other places? And they can't be carrying out civilian research. It's the Pentagon who controls these things. And, of course, that makes people very suspicious.
Well, it does.
And too.
It does. So, as far as the next few days go, or even the next few weeks, I mean, politically, what do you think is likely to happen?
Well, I think what you're seeing happen is people who try and score cheap points will look cheap. And I think you could sense that in the way that Boris is trying to, you know, sound a bit serious and actually be nice to Jeremy Corbyn, you know. The right honourable gentleman makes excellent points, blah, blah, blah. But the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. Yeah, if they say they're going to help the most vulnerable, well, they've got to do that. And if they don't do it, they're going to be held to account and say, well, why haven't you done what you said you were going to do? And that's actually the way things should be conducted, surely. And, of course, then at the end of it all, if there is an end, we will then go back and say, well, what did we do right, what did we do wrong? But one thing I'll make that absolutely clear, which makes me livid, is it's 12 years since the collapse of the banking system in 2008, and they've still not got a clue what to do. They should have been thinking about what are we going to do. But instead, they just presumed it was all fixed, and it wasn't fixed. People said, well, who predicted this? It's absolutely staring everybody in the face. Left-wing and right-wing economists have been saying, the academic ones, this can't go on, this can't go on, this can't go on. But they've just ignored it. Oh, it'll be all right. We'll bodge it. You can't bodge it. You're not going to bodge this one.
What do you think about the new Chancellor? Is this going to be a solution? Is he a hero?
Well, I mean, basically, he's got the hot seat. And, of course, the good news is that the whole... I mean, you see what Theresa May was trying to do there? She's carping from the sidelines, saying, well, we're not going to keep to our fiscal targets. It's like, well, no. But then fiscal targets might be a load of rubbish anyway. We didn't need to do austerity after the crash. What we should have done is put money in the pockets of the poorest and then what you could call trickle up. You refloat the banking system by giving money to the poorest. But in actual fact, they gave it to the richest in the idea that it was going to trickle down. And, of course, it hasn't trickled down. And now the most vulnerable, the zero-hours contract people, apart from the ones who are working in social care, of course, because they're going to be, you know, having to get more to do, they're all going to lose their jobs and it's all going to go down the drain. And this is absolutely predictable. When they say, well, who could have predicted coronavirus? Well, who could have predicted it apart from, I don't know, Donald Trump, for example, who on the day of 9/11 said, well, those buildings were bombed. I build these buildings for a living and those buildings were bombed. And you know what? Donald was right. The buildings were bombed, as the Russian general staff and the Chinese general staff well know. But of course, the ordinary punters still go along with the official understanding of what happened. Now, if you carry on, you know, I'm 60 years old. If people carry on believing shysters and charlatans, eventually they're going to be fleeced. Yeah. And that's what's going on.
Well, you said something, a chilling thing earlier, Martin. You said that we are all absorbed with shopping and our next holiday.
Well, I think that's what, you know, those who are relatively comfortable, they know they can't really change things, even if they wanted to. And you're then encouraged to just indulge your own private affairs and take no notice of what's going on because you can't do anything about it anyway. But as Aristotle said a long time ago, those who have no interest in politics have no place in our city. And I think that the depoliticisation of life is what I've seen in my lifetime. Yeah?
Yeah,
I mean, we really thought when Margaret Thatcher first came to power, I was a teenager, and we thought we're going to have a miners' strike and we're going to crack her out. And of course, we were much sadder and wiser five or six years later. And of course, society was remade in that era, and we set off on a trajectory which we're now reaching the end of that trajectory, which was the financialization of the economy, because the economy wasn't that financialized in the 1970s.
Looking back, though, to the Thatcher era, I can't help thinking that we've changed our attitudes. If somebody now proposed that it was a good idea to put thousands of men under the ground in the dark doing a dangerous job mm-hmm. like that. I think a lot of people go, no, we shouldn't be doing
well,
this.
Well, what I'd say about that, and I used to teach A-level economics in the late 80s, and one of the questions that the kids used to be asking of the A-level students, and they were given the stats about the coal industry. Now, in actual fact, some of it was non-viable. Yeah, some of it probably had to close. But others of it, as long as you're covering your variable costs, yeah?
Yeah.
There's no point closing it until you're not covering those variable costs. And even if you're going to run it down, you don't just close it bang like that. You run it down slowly and you look to other jobs that people could go to, which is how they would dealt with similar problems in Scandinavia. Yeah. If you've got to change the industrial structure, you know what you're trying to do, and you have got a plan to get everybody through what they need to do. But that was deliberately done as a confrontation so they could sack them all at once with no redundancy and all the rest of it, because they wanted to teach a lesson to the militant trade union movement of this country. And that they did. They smashed it. And, of course, the positives for them were that they could then financialise the economy in the way that they have. But the negative of that is that you end up in a situation where the banking system is completely fraudulent and collapses, which is the sort of thing that used to happen in the 19th century on a smaller scale. But this is massive. I mean, this is the biggest economic crisis in history by a long way, bigger than the 1930s.
Yes.
In the 1930s, economies weren't as integrated as they are now.
Yeah, I can see that governments often manipulate bad things, and the miners' strike was one of them. I mean, prior to the miners' strike, the Labour Party was basically holding up the government, wasn't it?
Well, no. I mean, the Labour Party, when Thatcher came to power, she never won a majority of the votes, you see. In another European country, she would never have been the Prime Minister.
Has any Prime Minister ever got one?
I think occasionally in the 50s, I think the Tories did actually win a majority of the votes. I'll have to look it up. But in actual fact, our system basically guarantees almost that the people who win won't have the majority of the votes. And of course, it's supposed to be okay because we get to bat. They get to bat, then we get to bat.
Yeah.
But of course, it's still a rubbish way to run it, which is why no European countries other than Britain runs it like that.
Yeah, but look at some other European countries. They've got this thing where there are so many parties, nobody knows who's who. Nobody is a clear winner.
Well, no, but the point is that they're used to dealing with a more flexible setup. Mm. And what you generally find, like in most countries, is there's a fairly strong right wing and a fairly strong left wing, but they're grouped into different teams. Yeah, and they're used to negotiating to get things. I mean, in Germany, it's fairly common. You've still got it happening now. The Social Democrats, their equivalent of the Labour Party, is part of a coalition with the Christian Democrats, who are basically the Conservative Party, because there's enough common ground for them to be in the government together. Unthinkable in our country.
Unthinkable in our country. I'm afraid a lot of people in this country mix up politics and sport. It's like, we're the team, we're the winners.
Well, that's right.
Actually,
yeah.
Sometimes you just have to pass the baton and work together.
Well, indeed. And, of course, all sport has been cancelled as a result of what's going on here. And, I'm a reasonably keen sports fan. And one of the things I like about sports and teaching kids sports is all this stuff about sportsmanship. You know, you don't win them all. And that's OK.
That's real sportsmanship. Sometimes when you look at the big football teams and you look at their supporters and you see the degree of passion and obsession, you think, actually, you know,
it's funny you should mention that, because of course in the late 80s with the rave scene and all the rest of it, the football hooliganism thing, that was one of the really good things of the era, is the football hooliganism thing just became uncool. Nobody was interested in it anymore. They were still interested in football,
yeah,
but they'd rather go out dancing and picking girls up than hitting each other with bottles. And that's all to the good, in my view.
Maybe we need to retrain the politicians down the same lines.
Well, I mean, I think you get there. What happens? I mean, one of the things that made Britain function after the war was a lot of the guys on both sides of the political divide had fought in the war together. And there was a national government during the war. You know, Churchill didn't run the country on his own. There was no, you know, Ken Attlee, who eventually became the Prime Minister, was in the cabinet throughout the war.
Yeah.
As was Ernie Bevin, who was the trade unionist from Bristol. And I was just leaning back in the M shed. Ernie Bevan and Churchill went down to the south coast on the day before D-Day to talk to the guys, and one of the guys said to Ernie Bevan, "Ernie, if we do this job for you, when we come back, are we going to be put on the dole?" And he said, "No, you're not. Absolutely not." And Churchill was standing beside him as they said that. Now, those were the days.
Those were the days, and nobody would call them the good old days, but they were very definitive days.
They were, and of course what happened in that era was there was a general change of attitude towards free markets and wealth inequality and so on. You know, if we're all going to be bombed in our houses, then, you know, we're all contributing and we all expect to be looked after, you know. I mean, that's one of the things that came to the health service. You don't deal with people in when they've been bombed from the air by saying, "Where's your health insurance?" You drag them out and you sort them out.
Yeah.
And of course, the US has never had anything like that, which is why they think that socialised medicine is such an evil thing. But the government gets to decide who gets treated and everything's terrible. But of course, it's actually the way to do it. Of course it is.
Yeah. Talking of medicine, our friend Tony sent me a link about the coronavirus thing. There's a new article on this. It says, how does the new coronavirus compare with the flu? And in this article, it says that although the coronavirus has made headlines in recent weeks, there is another viral epidemic hitting countries around the world. And it is just flu. This is the flu season.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I'll take that point. But I think there's two things. You know, people die anyway of flu and all sorts of things, but they generally die in poorer communities and in poorer societies, so we don't notice. Yeah?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, of course, that this thing about coronavirus, which is one of the things that made people think it's a bioweapon, is because it takes so long for people who've been infected to show symptoms.
Yeah.
Which is what you'd want with a bioweapon designed to bring down an economy. You don't want to kill loads of people. You just want to mess things up a bit. And, of course, the Chinese last year, all their pig herd died of African swine fever.
Oh.
So they then had to buy pork from the Americans, who were there at daggers drawn with on the trade front. And then as this thing was kicking off with the coronavirus, they lost all their chicken flock to bird flu.
Yeah.
And then this comes along, and if I was a paranoid old communist dictator, I might think, you're trying to get at us, aren't you?
Well, in the US, flu alone has caused an estimated 36 million illnesses, 370,000 hospitalisations and 22,000 deaths this season.
Yeah, well, that's happened every season. But, I mean, the thing about coronavirus is it's more deadly. And in any case, whether the economic effects of it, if it's a biological warfare, psychological warfare thing, that the economic effects are there. Yeah?
Yeah.
Most people are very unaware of what health statistics are all about anyway. But, of course, the Spanish flu, if we can come to that, in 1918, it was called the Spanish flu because Spain wasn't involved in the First World War and they had no censorship of their newspapers. So the first cases, when people started dying in large numbers, they reported it in Spain, but it wasn't reported in other countries. The source of the Spanish flu was actually a military facility in Kansas in the US, where they were assembling all their doughboys, as they call them, to send them off to fight on the Western Front. And they gave them all, guess what? Experimental flu vaccines.
Yes, because...
Because, of course, you can imagine people fighting in trench conditions. They get flu, they get ill, they die, because you die of flu, and you spread it to everybody else, and it reduces your military efficiency, blah, blah, blah. So the pharmaceutical companies of the day said, well, we can sort that out for you. Why don't we just, give them a vaccine for flu before they go? So they developed a vaccine, which they developed from glanders in horses, and they injected it all into these guys. And, of course, they basically gave them lethal flu, and then they spread it around all over the place, and it's been covered up for years, this. But people can check this, they can look it up. It may be that it just was a random virus, but of course it wasn't helped by the fact that because of the war, all these people are moving around. I mean, you know, farmers' boys that used to just live in the little town they lived in the Midwest end up in the south of France,
yeah,
because of the war.
Well, it's no surprise then that it took so long to get a proper flu vaccine, and there are still people now who are nervous of being vaccinated against flu because they fear that they may catch flu.
Well, I think one of the problems with flu viruses is that flu mutates. So you can, you know, even if you've had flu, you can get it again and again. You know, it's always been a big killer of human beings in the Northern Hemisphere.
And that's why when they give you the flu injection, they say to you, and this year we think that this strain and this strain are the ones we're fighting.
Yeah. But this COVID-19 virus is very unusual, and obviously there are scientists looking into it. So there was a scientist in Taiwan who went on TV and said, well, and he showed that to the satisfaction. I mean, Taiwan, of course, is an enemy of China. Yeah. So they're not the sort of people that would say this. And he said, well, look at it. There's five different haplotypes of this virus, and they're all present in the US, but there's only one haplotype of it present in China. And another different one present in Iran. Now, this all starts to look a bit fishy, doesn't it?
It does, really. But you can never tell with these things.
Well, no, but the point is that there's plausible deniability built into to a psychological warfare operation like this, like 9/11. Yeah? It's all planned in advance. And they know it's very hard to prove and all the rest of it, and they can bluff it. But of course, you can fool all of the people all of the time, and some of people all of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And the people that you really got to fool are the Chinese secret services, the Russian secret services, etc. And they've got a lot of money and resources, and you're not going to fool them if you've done something like this. And they're going to take note.
And of course, it's unavoidable that, you know, whatever happens, it will come to pass. And the world will be a massively changed place.
It's quite clear. This is a massive inflection point. There's no disputing that. It's been a very, very strange week for everybody, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's very strange. Now, we're about to have the news, and then after that, we'll be talking to our guest, Anthony Negus, the Liberal Democrat councillor for Bristol, and he will be telling us what they plan in his party or what they're thinking of further ahead. Because at the moment, it's almost as though there is no future. People just live from one virus news to the next, and it's hugely upsetting.
Well, if you read the Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, she says that basically it's all based on the idea of what arrest people, you shock them into a different reality very quickly so that you disorient them. This is why they put bags over the heads and stuff like this. And so she did research into all of these things.
Well, there we are. Here's the news then, and we'll be back after this.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.